A battle over anti-corruption legislation in India has led to major protests, some of the largest the subcontinent has seen in decades. And at the center of it all is Anna Hazare, a 74-year-old activist who's been on a hunger strike for over a week. Meera Kamdar, senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and associate fellow at the Asia Society, fills us in on what's going on there for today's Backstory segment. Welcome back to our show.
Glad to be back, Leonard.
Writers called the protest a digital groundswell of a wired middle class that echoes the Arab Spring. Do you think this is a middle class uprising? An Indian summer, kind of?
Well, I think that's too facile a comparison to make. I mean, certainly the role that new media, Facebook and Twitter, have played is significant and new, but I think that's true of almost any kind of movement around the world now because this is the way people communicate. A minority of Indians have access to the internet, so yes, it would be mostly the middle class who are being inspired to get involved that way. But you can't underestimate also the role of television, and this has been highly, highly seized upon by India's very active media, and it's a kind of a nonstop 24/7 television event, and that medium is reaching millions and millions of Indians who aren't part of this quote unquote middle class.
Well, as I mentioned, an anti-corruption bill is at the center of it all. Why is that the main issue in India when the protests in so many other countries are over public debt, food prices, and other economic issues? And in India, there are millions of poor people who have been left behind, even as the economy has taken off.
Well, that's true, and one of the even less underreported, or even more underreported headlines about India right now is that food prices continue to climb, and of course the poor are hit by that the hardest. But I think the corruption issue encapsulates for a lot of Indian citizens all these other issues, because what's really happening here is a crisis of governance. The Indian government has simply not been able to deliver enough basic services to enough of the people. There's a growing sense of unfairness, and a lot of the emotion behind this, I think, is over a question of justice and fairness in a democracy. You have the gap between the rich and the poor that's grown, as it is everywhere in the world. You have a new culture of showing off private wealth, and you've had these incredibly spectacular orgies of displays of billion-dollar fortunes, including by politicians who, through their government salaries, could never afford to, gift the bride's family with a helicopter, as happened with one Congress politician earlier this year. And I think that people are just fed up who in daily life have to pay bribes, to get a birth certificate or to get a cop off their back.
But hasn't corruption been a part of the Indian political system since 1948?
Well, probably even before that. But yeah, no, you're right. And, a lot was made when India started economic liberalization, that with the end of what was called the license Raj, that this kind of thing would now be over. But in fact, it's snowballed with economic liberalization, and the scale has just become incredible. And then again, with the role of media, especially television, everyone has seen, the spectacular corruption scandal around the Commonwealth Games, and then that followed by the even more spectacular corruption scandal with the Minister of Telecommunications and the billions of dollars with recorded telephone calls between, lobbyists and top journalists over, why isn't this guy in the ministership? We paid enough and things like that. And people, I think, are just at a state of such disgust that the timing, and we can talk about the particular, way this has taken off, but the timing of the emergence of this Gandhi-like figure has just been the spark that's lit the flame.
Well, you're talking about Anna Hazare, and let's remind our listeners that my guest is Meera Kamdar of the World Policy Institute and the Asia Society. We're talking about the protests in India as on today's Backstory segment on our show. Tell us about Anna Hazare. Does he have a long history of social activism?
He does. He, you know, started his career as a military man, was very disillusioned with life at one point, thought of killing himself, and then, you know, decided to dedicate himself to the upliftment of the poor. He adopted a village in his native state of Maharashtra and really turned it around and made it into a very prosperous, kind of self-supporting, sustainable agriculture place on the Gandhian village model.
But I'm confused about him. On the one hand, he seems to be a fairly hardline Hindu nationalist, and yet, and he's been compared to Mahatma Gandhi on the other, and also the Congress Party has tried to paint him as an undercover Maoist rebel. So that puts him all over the place, doesn't it?
Well, the attacks are all over the place. You're very right to bring out his linkages with the Hindu right, and he has not hesitated to, you know, be seen on podia with Hindu right leaders. He's made remarks that support that kind of ideology. The overtones of Hindu nationalism in his campaign are very disturbing to a lot of people. He's also been very opposed to affirmative action in India, so that it seems that he sort of does not support getting rid of the ills of the caste system and things like that. He's a problematic figure. And, you know, this image that's been broadcast and reprinted in the world press of this huge portrait of Mahatma Gandhi behind the dais where he's on his hunger strike in Delhi, to associate him with Gandhi is very misleading, because he is a Gandhian in the sense of his dedication to the poor, but he's not at all a Gandhian in some of these other aspects. And I don't think that Gandhi would resort to some of the very facile comparisons that he's made, you know, like most recently saying everyone in the Congress Party is a looter, and encourage people on the streets, where the crowds are already very excited to go demonstrate outside of individual people's homes who have not been charged with any specific thing, you know. So he's a very problematic figure.
Well, the Financial Times reports that in his early years of social reform, he tied people who disobeyed an alcohol ban in his village to trees. Which strikes me as not very Gandhian, but Gandhian is his use of fasting. Why has that been so controversial?
Well, you know, there's this traditional figure in India of the sannyasin, the person who, you know, withdraws from society to pursue spiritual upliftment. And Gandhi's innovation was to make of himself a sannyasin, but to connect his personal spiritual quest and his asceticism with a popular mass movement for political change. And one of the tools that he used to very great effect toward the end of his career, frankly, when his power was waning, was the hunger strike. You know, he would go on a personal hunger strike, and then the British would get scared that if he died, there would be complete anarchy in the streets, which is exactly the fear of the Congress government in India right now.
Is that why they jailed him for fasting?
Yes, they jailed him, then they released him, then he very, very savagely, he's a very savvy guy, you know, refused to leave jail. And now they're begging him. Manmohan Singh, the Prime Minister's plea today was just really like, please don't die on us, because they're really scared that if that were to happen, there'd be utter anarchy.
Well, what does he want? There are a couple of anti-corruption bills out there. The Congress Party has one, but he's supporting a different one. How many concessions has Anna Hazara been able to get included in the version of the anti-corruption bill he wants?
He's already been able to get a lot of concessions. I mean, this bill goes way back. The first Lokpal bill was launched in 1968. It's had many incarnations over the years. It's never been passed, but it's been a sort of residual effort and issue. The government has really come a long way to satisfying his demands, but he says, and his movement says, they're satisfied with nothing less than 100% of what he wants, and there are these three sort of sticking points left that are very technical. The government has said, well, let's refer this to Parliament for a vote. Just start eating, please. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, no, until you give me everything I want, I'm not going to eat.
And what are the sticking points? Are they things that resonate with the public?
I don't think think the specifics of the bill actually resonate with the public. I think the public, because there are a lot of different points, and, you know, should the Prime Minister, for example, be open to investigations by this independent committee? Who should be on the committee? These kinds of questions. I don't think the public is very concerned, the masses that are in the street, with the technicalities of the bill. I think what they're concerned with is someone is finally, you know, giving vent to their frustration and bringing the government to a point of having some kind of reckoning. I also don't think the public is conscious, as a lot of India's elite is, with the sort of threat that having this charismatic figure with the problematic aspects that we've just discussed, the links with the Hindu right and all the rest of it, you know, sort of do an end run around the institutions of democracy. However defective those institutions may be, you know, the political health of India depends on reforming those institutions and not shattering them or making them completely irrelevant.
Well, wasn't the Congress Party only recently reelected in India? Is this damaging it? I'm assuming that Prime Minister Singh, who's a trained economist, doesn't have the kind of charisma we might expect in a forceful leader.
He has almost no charisma. He's openly seen to be more or less the figurehead. The real power behind the party is Sonia Gandhi, who stepped aside since she was foreign born, and the opposition BJP made a big deal about that when the Congress initially came to power, and Manmohan Singh took the office. He's been encouraged to run for a seat in Parliament. He's declined to do that, perhaps because he's unsure of his chances of success. His political credibility at this point is near zero. And I think that, unfortunately, the Congress Party, in clinging to power around a fairly impotent figure, frankly, and in refusing to, submit themselves to a kind of verdict of the people, has opened themselves up to this other kind of verdict of the people that Anna Hazare is leading.
Now, Mira, a listener, David from Fredericksburg, Virginia, wrote in on our show page, "I came in the middle of the story, and I thought you were talking about the United States."
Well, you know, all democracies are defective, and it seems a lot of them in the world are fairly spectacularly defective right now in different ways. But India has its own specificities.
And you called your book Planet India, The Turbulent Rise of the Largest Democracy. I guess these are the pains that we're seeing now from as a result of the switch from socialism, which nobody seemed to be happy with, to capitalism, which nobody seems to be happy with.
Well, there was always capitalism, and the socialism of India's big business houses were there, and they were actually for many years quite happy to have the Indian market protected from bigger, richer foreign corporations.
Mira, I have to leave it there, unfortunately. I want to thank you so much for talking with us today on Backstory. Mira Kamdar is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and an associate fellow at the Asia Society. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Leonard.